You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.com. We'll be here live every Wednesday from 11 to 11:30, and our topic is going to be, you guessed it, taste. Really excited to have this show, to actually have a space on the air to talk about taste in a way that I think we often forget taste and its importance. We live in a culture here that's obsessed with food, and we aren't always allowed to talk about the way food tastes. We sort of talk about it tangentially, or we think, oh, it's good or it's bad. But our intent here with this show, and you're listening to the first episode, the first segment, so we are hoping that our intent is going to be met. But the idea is to really explore this concept of taste in its broadest sense. Things people like, things people talk about, the way taste permeates our culture, to really open up the discourse, to use an awful word, an academic word, but to get into what makes a food culture and to look at it through this perspective of taste. I'm the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, and obviously we're a taste-making organization of some sort, but taste isn't always just about the finest chefs or the most expensive things, and that's really what we want to explore here and look at the entire food system and how, with a different perspective on the way that things taste, that flavors and our concept of culture comes through the senses, and food being one of the most sensual and sensuous things is an incredible avenue for that. Of course, we could talk about fashion and art and all sorts of other concepts of taste, but for me, taste is really about what happens when we eat and enjoy food. And I'm really excited today to have two guests on this show, the inaugural episode, two friends and two tastemakers themselves in their own rights. We'll be talking with Gabriella Gershenson, who is the senior editor at Saveur magazine, a magazine named for taste, in fact. Saveur meaning flavor in French, and it was in fact built originally on the French magazine Saveur. And also joining us in the second part of the show will be Isabella Wojcik, who's the director of house programming at the James Beard Foundation. And in that role, Isabella invites or oversees the programming of the invitations of chefs to the Beard House, and she'll tell us all about that process and how we construct taste from that perspective. But more to the point, we're here really to just talk about we're here to talk about food in a way that emphasizes the sensual pleasures, the sensory pleasures, and the way that those permeate our culture. So, Gabriella, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining me on our first show.
Thank you.
It feels like we're playing radio here at Roberta's in Brooklyn, where we're sitting watching them get ready for lunch in an incredible restaurant, and I'm so glad that you could be here to help us break into it.
It's an honor to play radio with you and Isabella.
Thanks,
Gabriella.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about you and what you do at Saveur and the magazine itself, and particularly I'm interested in the tagline and the philosophy of taste at that magazine.
Saveur is a really interesting magazine. It's sort of unique in the dialogue about food that's happening in this country right now. Saveur is really focusing on taste as tradition and everyday foods in a lot of ways. One of the big things that we pride ourselves on and that we take pains to do is we travel within the United States and all over the world and really ask people, please show us what you would eat if we weren't here. or we try to, you know, crash a wedding and see how people celebrate if they don't think the food magazine is going to come and look over their shoulders. And in that way, we try to get an insight into how people nourish themselves every day and the foods that they really return to. And that's a matter of real culture, the way a person feeds themselves day in and day out. And that's something that we try to capture in the magazine.
Mm-hmm. So you said real culture. So I think you are alluding to this idea of an authenticity of food experience or an authenticity of flavor?
Absolutely. And it is, you know, a world of authentic flavor, savor a world of authentic flavor. That's our tagline at Savour. And authentic is, you know, it's such a tricky word. But the truth is that, yes, that's what we're seeking out. And, you know, coming in as outsiders a lot of the time, of course, you're not going to get the exact experience that you might get if, say, you know, you're visiting a place where you grew up or you live for many years. But it's definitely an attempt on our part to not create myths about places, but to try to tap into a truth about how people feed themselves.
Interesting. So for people who might be a little bit less familiar with sort of a magazine and how it works in the editorial process, and obviously everyone is different, why don't you talk a little bit just about the day-to-day? I mean, how, put us in an editorial meeting at Savour and talk about what that looks like.
Bleep, bleep, bleep. No, just kidding. We're a very passionate bunch. Well, you know, say we're planning the editorial calendar for 2012. There's so many goals that we're trying to reach, you know, just the nuts and bolts that we have a front of book and a back of book. So the front of book would include, you know, we have different rubrics, which are sort of these longstanding formats that we write to. So one might be classic, which is a great, great section where we examine the history and the evolution of a beloved food like duck a l'orange or sweet potato casserole or Swedish meatballs.
Maybe we shouldn't have timed this show before lunch. Anyway, the idea is to make you hungry. So yes.
You know, we have reported pieces, you know, we might do something about the way strawberries are raised and cultivated in this country. So we also take a more, I guess, non-glamorous and political angle toward food reporting. We have a front of book section called Fair, where we have a lot of really nice bite-sized kind of repertorial pieces as well about aspects of food culture from around the world that you just might never have known about otherwise. Like, for instance, in an upcoming issue, we have a story about this enormous composed salad that's served in Guatemala on Day of the Dead, and it has about 50 ingredients. Oh. And it has a great story behind it. Right. So that gives a sense of the front of book, and the back of book are the features. So that's when, you know, say, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who's a really, you know, renowned Mediterranean food authority, she'll go to Sicily and she'll report on the food traditions there. And, you know, we go to people's homes mm-hmm. when we report on these food stories. That's a distinction maybe I should have made earlier. You know, we also go to chefs' kitchens just to get a well-rounded view of cuisine in the place we're highlighting. But we go to people's homes and we say, will you cook this for us? So when we're putting together an edit meeting, you know, we try to get a variety and like a nice, interesting sort of eclectic balance in each issue. We try to make sure that recipes from one story to another give enough variety so that, you know, we're not running a feature on pesto and then doing a spaghetti alla carbonara for our classic. So it's all, you know, in certain ways, it's very intuitive. But in other ways, and this plays into the issue of taste, curating a magazine is an arbitrary science that makes sense, but in a very intangible, difficult to describe kind of way.
Right. And we'll get back to that, because I think one of the things that we forget is we often think of taste as a personal thing. Oh, I like this or I don't like that. And one of the things I think that distinguishes culture here and food culture in America is that emphasis on the personal, both in food and in everything, on the me, whereas there are other negotiations of taste in other cultures that I think are important, and we'll talk a little bit about that. I want to remind our listeners that they can call in and ask questions of our guests or of the future of the show, and maybe we'll all figure it out together. And the number for that is 718-497-2128. Again, you're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis, and my guest is Gabriella Gershenson from Savour Magazine. So in addition to the magazine, you also were a judge on the 24-hour restaurant battle on the Food Network, and it was a fascinating show, and I think an indicator of a cool phenomenon, which I find the judges table phenomenon really interesting on television, that we've gone from not really thinking about our food at all to actually watching experts, sometimes more expert than other times, debating taste. So, you know, the end of Top Chef or the end of 24-Hour Restaurant Battle, you're sitting there with some other people, a chef, a business person, an actor, whatever, discussing what just happened and what you think of the way the food tasted, sort of creating this discourse of taste that I think is really important. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your personal experience in that situation.
It's so interesting. What I loved the most doing the show was when we disagreed.
Right.
You know,
makes for good TV too.
Well, it was just so interesting because we all respected each other's opinions. The host was Scott Conant. Alison Brod is a, you know, she's a PR maven and she was on many episodes as well. Jeffrey Zakarian, who
great restaurateur.
And then we had a great rotating cast of guest judges like Drewny Porent from Nobu, you know, Ben Leventhal, who founded Eater. And it was always so fascinating to disagree. I remember one pointed sort of girls against boys disagreement we had. It was really
great. Taste and gender will be a future show topic, perhaps.
Yes, right? I thought that would be amazing. Karine Bakum, who owns KB Network News, which is also a very important publicity firm for restaurants in New York. And she's also the Iron Palate, I guess, on Iron Chef.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Right. So Karine and I were eating a fava bean pasta dish, and we just thought it was murky. We thought it was a little, you know, kind of dry and a bit, you know, like funky in a not very pleasant way. And we just didn't think it was successful. And Scott Conant, and I think that Marcus Samuelson was the other chef, they thought it was, you know, this refreshing dish. They thought it was, you know, real and rustic, and they really loved what was going on.
Interesting.
And we had a great spirited debate about it. And I think the best part about that kind of debate is when you're dealing with people who you trust without a doubt that they have a very high taste level, and yet they're experiencing something on a totally different plane than you are.
Right.
You know, it really is. We were talking about taste being subjective or not being subjective. It's an interesting and complex relationship because on the one hand, you can have a very trained palate, unimpeachable. On the other hand, two unimpeachable palates can have a totally different take on a dish. One more thing that struck me about the experience of being on a panel of judges was that even if we disagreed on individual dishes, we always, without, you know, we didn't even have to talk about it. We knew who was the winner and who was the loser at the end.
Oh, interesting.
There was no debate. It was obvious.
Right. So which speaks to there perhaps being, well, either you guys are of a collective taste community that can come to some consensus, because perhaps another group before might have come to a different conclusion. You never know, which is something that I hope to explore. But also that perhaps there is some platonic taste, something true outside the negotiations of what is good or what is bad that we can all aspire to in some way.
I mean, like the idea of that.
Interesting. What do you think, I've heard in the past, I mean, let's get back to this gender issue. I've heard that women make better wine tasters because of some various biological, physiological things. Do you think that in that instance, do you think that it was boys against girls because of something distinct or just because you had, your opinions were better than the guys?
Geez.
Maybe a stupid question.
No, it's not a stupid question at all. I don't know. I love making things into about gender sometimes, but in this instance, I have to say, you know, I feel like it was a matter of individual taste.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I'll think about that because, you know, it's definitely, whether there's truth to there being, you know, certain taste advantages or disadvantages per gender, maybe you could have a scientist on the show to talk about it.
Right.
But it's a matter that interests me very much.
Sure. Well, we certainly, you know, Yes, Isabella's raising her hand. Yes. Can you see that at home?
Anyway. I know my guest turn is coming up, and it's not quite my turn yet, but I actually do have one experience. So I just want to jump in to talk about
everyone, this. Everyone, this is Isabella Wojcik. She's the director of house programming at the James Beard Foundation, and you'll meet her even more later. But tell
I'm coming soon, but I'm coming right now with this experience. So I was privileged to attend something at Astor Center that was specifically that. It was the question of gender in food, and the idea was to have female and male chefs and even mixologists kind of prepare dishes using the same ingredients. So it might be like a lamb or it might be a pasta, whatever that agreed ingredient was, and then to have them prepare it in a certain way, whatever that was, but to think about the idea of gender in cooking. Is there such a thing? And then there's a panel of judges. They got to taste the dishes. So a lot of the opinions came down to, you know, it's a little dry or it's a little this, it's a little that. It came down to flavor and taste. But ultimately, there was no consensus about what role gender played, because I think part of it was the chefs were trying to, you know, the pink drink is either definitely made by a female or made by
definitely
the male,
made by a male,
you know,
to impersonate a female.
So it was a little bit like that. And can women make bold, rustic, lusty, masculine flavors? And can a chef make something very fussy and delicate? And so in the end, they're really just it. We decided there was no way to make that decision.
Despite Alan Richman, the GQ restaurant critic who believes only women like sardines, for instance.
Interesting.
All right. Well, we're
I don't
at
know
the
if I should be offended or not by that.
Well, no, you should ask for his sardines if he ever gets them in a restaurant. We're at the halfway point, so let's take a break and we'll come back and continue this conversation.
Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal thief, public enemy number one. 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X bun. Now they got me in a cell, cause my records they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you wanna listen to what he can say to you. What you wanna do is follow for now. Power the people say, make a miracle, keep up the lyrical. Black is back, all in, we're gonna win, check it out.
Yeah, yo, come on.
Here we go again. The brother is madder than mad at the fact it's corrupt like a senator. Soul on the road, but you treat it like soap on a rope, cause the beats and the lies are so dope. Listen for lessons I'm saying inside music.
Well, thank you, Flava Flav. It's not really, you're not really about singing about taste, but we just think your name is so important that we had to put you on the show. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis on heritageradionetwork.com. I am your host, Mitchell Davis, and I'm here with Gabriella Gershenson, from senior editor of Sever Magazine, and Isabella Wojcik, House Director of House Programming at the James Beard Foundation.
And the interrupter.
And the interrupter. But it's your turn, baby. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and what the James Beard Foundation is before we get into the conversation about taste.
Well, I would relish the experience of describing what I do, because what we do is so tasty and wonderful. But to be honest, I have a really incredible job. I feel very privileged to do it. I love coming to work every day. Namely, the Beard House, this historic little old townhouse, is used as an event space for visiting guest chefs, for visitors. And it's kind of where the consumers, food enthusiasts, chefs, winemakers, the media all kind of converge and dine at the table. And the experience is very much about learning, remembering, socializing, but through eating and drinking, not at all about talking about it as much as the whole experience of it. And what I do is to invite chefs to come and cook, and I have to fill the program calendar with kind of diverse, interesting, unique, compelling events. Filtered through the idea of what will sell, what will appeal to a New York or tri-state area based consumer, and what's relevant, and how to incorporate into that idea of a performance, relevance, culinary artistry, how to incorporate everybody from fine dining chefs to maybe more rustic, regional, localized chefs to chefs that are working in the private sector, whether it's, you know, country clubs or other kinds of private communities, private chefs, and how to kind of create something very unique, you know, weekly and monthly.
Mm-hmm. So if you go to jamesbeard.org, you can see the calendar of what's going on.
Under the events tab, absolutely.
And all sorts of other things. So what is the process of inviting a chef? Obviously, being asked to cook at the Beard House is viewed in the chef community and also in the world as a banner, an honor of sorts, that basically a taste-making moment, let's say.
Yes, and it's also, it seems to be a rite of passage. Okay. So when we first started, the idea was to preserve the house, have some people cooking, fundraising, really just about James Beard, people who knew James Beard and were connected to him. So I think back in 1986, 87, 88, in the early years of the foundation, there are some important chefs on the scene at that point. So almost 25 years later, we're in the third generation. We're in meaning there are chefs who came with those early chefs, you know, the Jimmy Sneed or Larry Forgione or Wolfgang Puck. They had teams with them who remembered that experience, wanted their own experience, became those chefs who were pioneers, you know, 10 years later, who came and now were in that third generation of their sous chefs and their cuisine, you know, their staff who now are coming up in the ranks and want to have their own experience. So it's very much, I think, a rite of passage for chefs that are working in New York who have restaurants here. I think we have a little bit different of a relationship because they are here. Their businesses are here. They could be in their restaurant, but they still want to come to the Beard House to kind of have that experience, both to share it with their staff, but also to reach people in a very unique way. You know, guests have to walk through the kitchen. You have to meet the chef. You have to see the action happening, which is part of the performance. They're cooking for you, which not at every restaurant, at every moment, that chef is touching your plate, preparing your food. So that uniqueness and that intimacy is still something that is very special to the chefs, even in New York City-based restaurants. For chefs that work outside of New York, I think there's that sentiment of, I want to perform in New York. You know, I want to come and cook for a New York audience, for the food media, for the people that are here. I mean, this is, you know, perceived as a great food city. The people here are sophisticated, you know, have lots of food experiences, are opinionated tastemakers, and they want to cook for these people. So there's that sense of coming to New York to cook.
So one of the things that fascinates me, obviously, I know this because I work there, but I also know this because of the improbability of it, that you personally do not eat in all of the restaurants of the chefs that come, so you haven't physically tasted the food, but obviously you are making decisions in a certain way about who gets to come, and I know that the mentality is more inclusive than exclusive, although sometimes the perception is different. But why don't you talk a little bit about that selection process?
Sure, absolutely. And to be honest, I feel very much like I don't actually have to have tasted the food, because it's not about criticism and it's not about just my own opinion. I mean, the subjectiveness factors into it when I think about, well, who's the chef? What are his or her credentials? What business are they working in now? What is their food like? What are their aspirations? What do they hope their restaurant or their business achieves? And really, how are they placed in their own community? What's the opinion in their own community of what they're trying to do? And if I think it's relevant in a way that could be a great holiday dinner or a specific theme at the Beard House, or if it's relevant to region. Like, it's very easy for me to get chefs from Chicago, but from South Dakota or from Iowa, it's trickier. So it's about the idea of having regionality represented. If I think someone can represent a great region, a great foodways, great wines, I feel like it's the making of a successful event. So I look at the criteria based on their biography, what business they're in now, what kinds of cooking styles they have, what they're doing, what they would like to do in New York. Ultimately, though, it's about you know, almost like a catered event. It's a banquet. It's a private dinner party in James Beard's home. So you can't always determine, based on what a chef does in a restaurant, how great they cook for a party of four and then a party of six. You can't always tell how that's going to translate into a dinner at the Beard House, where space is very confined, where your menu has to think about the equipment, the timing, and factor all of that in, which forces you to think and plan differently. So to me, it's about, do I feel like this chef deserves that spot? And are they offering something really unique to continue our legacy? Or are they just hoping that by cooking at the Beard House, they automatically get an award? You know, and I'm trying to dispel that notion that there's that relationship. So if I feel that they can come and support the foundation, if they can create something very unique and special, I really just want to share that with the diners. That's the mentality.
So one of the things that I find interesting also about that is that so much goes into the selection and the chef's obviously work that they're going to represent there. And then, in fact, the other half of the taste-making equation of the Beard House are really the people in the dining room. And you can look at sort of various theories of taste and class and all sorts of stuff in the academic world to see that taste is sort of this two-way conversation, this two-way negotiation. And in fact, part of what makes the Beard Foundation such an important thing is the perception of the people who are there to eat it, whether they're elite people in the world or whether they're food people or something. Can you talk a little bit about the people who come to dinner? I mean, they're open to everyone, which not everyone understands, actually.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, certainly we promote it exclusively to our membership because our members are loyal supporters of the foundation and they're the diners. So we do a lot of work to really entice our own members. However, we're very much open to the public. Anyone can come. It's first reserved, you know, first come, first reserved. And we hope that that universe is broader than just our own members. However, who are our members? I mean, they're food enthusiasts in one way that are unified that way. But within that, everyone's got their own perception of what they like to eat, what they will eat. You know, I feel like maybe New York isn't as adventurous as it would like to think in terms of consumer tastes and what people are willing to spend money on and what they're willing to eat.
So this is the idea of what we are as a sophisticated food loving culture.
And we are
city,
that just by virtue of the number of businesses here, the number of cooking styles,
the density of population,
the things you could eat. It's incredible.
But when push comes to shove, maybe we don't want rabbit brains.
Not yet.
Not, or we don't want to pay for it at the beer house sometimes. Well, before we switch, I should say a couple of things. One is that, Isabella, you are going to be hosting the show from time to time. We're all in a busy schedule, and next week is your show, and I think you're going to be talking about the fear of tastes or taste
monkey
of
brains.
Fear. Monkey brains, anyone. As someone who is an adventurous eater and also an incredible internal chronicler of the process of what's going on inside of you, I think that's going to be a fascinating show with your guests. I will remind our audience at home that you can still call in and ask questions today and any day by dialing 718-497-2128. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. Let's go back to Gabriella and let's talk about, let's forget this sort of theoretical taste and let's talk about some things you've tasted recently that you've enjoyed. I'm about to try the cupcake you brought, which which is could be a whole many, many episodes, the whole cupcake trend.
About the cupcake.
Yes, although not as beautiful and delicious as this one. I'm about to taste it, but anything that's excited you lately that you've tried or tasted?
Oh my God, I'm on the spot. let me think. Well, I'll tell you something I'm excited about. It's really, speaking of food and gender, after bringing cupcakes, I'm going to mention macarons. I'm really excited that La Durée has opened in New York City because I'm a total Francophile, and I'm actually working on a story about French pastry right now. And you guys at home can't see this, but I'm about to show Mitchell and Isabella just like the greatest food porno book I've ever seen in my life.
Paris Patisseries.
It's called Paris Patisseries. The cover is a religieuse, which is one of the signature pastries at La Durée, which is basically one big round eclair as a base for a little tiny eclair on top of it. So I'm excited that their macarons are in New York right now.
Yeah. And Isabella, how about you? Something you've tasted recently or that excites you that you can say on the air?
That's a whole other show. absolutely. Well, so part of my job is editing menus, reading menus. And if you think about reading menus all day long from chefs, multiple courses, multiple wine pairings, certain cooking trends come up and then I start to, they sort of embed themselves in my head. And then I start to feel like I really want that and I crave it until I satisfy it. So lately it's been sea urchin pasta. And
wow.
I've just been thinking about it, in a seafood pasta or just... So I did recently satisfy my craving in Healdsburg, California, where I had kind of a macaroni and cheese, but it was macaroni. The cheesiness and the creaminess came from sea urchin, and then it had some tiny little bay scallops, very sweet, and just some toasted breadcrumbs. And it perfectly hit the spot. And I realized that the guests at my table were not really enjoying it as much as I was, because number one, they'd never had sea urchin. So I think they were still getting used to it. But I don't think they could understand how somebody could actually crave that dish. But I craved it, and there it was on the menu. I had it, and it was fabulous.
And this is exactly why, ladies and gentlemen at home, that you're going to enjoy listening to Isabella talk about food. Because how many people out there who are of Polish descent crave sea urchin pasta atop of the list and are delighted to satisfy that craving? We just have a couple of minutes left. Are there any last words you guys want to say about taste? I hope this is not this is the first time you're here, the first time we're on the air, but I hope it's not the last time you're here because we could talk about so many things for so long. Let's talk about these cupcakes for a second I'm still getting the chocolate icing out of my mouth. Well, just
what's
the basic
flavor,
recipe?
Gabriella?
Delicious.
What's your cupcake?
Okay, first of all, I'm going to make an admission on the air. I made my own frosting, but the cake is courtesy of Trader Joe's.
Oh,
I actually used a mix because I was lazy. The frosting is from Smitten
Kitchen.
Doesn't
taste like, doesn't have that mix taste.
Well, that's because I only buy like mixes moist. That have actually good ingredients. So that's the way I justified it myself using a mix. So
and everyone else online at Trader Joe's. But anyway, yes.
There's a stick of butter in there, and there's a cup of milk in there, and two eggs. So that's probably masking any.
So the mix is flour and sugar, basically. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. But I want to shout out to Smitten Kitchen because it's a website I go to continually for really great recipes. She seems to have cooked everything I've ever craved. So I just go there and I'm looking for a good recipe. So the frosting is from her, and it's pretty much it's a ganache made with sour cream and bittersweet chocolate, and that's it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about sour cream. It tastes a little sour. And by the way, Smitten Kitchen, fantastic photographs on top of great recipes.
And 1 second for a plug about the Dine Out Irene program that you're helping to coordinate?
Yes. Listeners, please check dineoutirene.com. It's a website with a list of participating restaurants. Sunday, September 25th, they're going to be raising money for the farms that have been hard hit by Hurricane Irene.
And the James Beard Foundation is one of those
Absolutely.
Restaurants participating.
Eat brunch.
We have a great
Foundation.
Brunch.
Yeah.
So remember, you're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. That's the end of our show. We're on Heritage Radio Network, where this show is archived, so you can listen to it at another time, heritageradionetwork.com. We'll be back Wednesdays at 11 to 11:30. Next week, you'll be with Isabella Wojcik, House Director of House Programming from the James Beard Foundation.
And, eater at large.
And in the meantime, eat something delicious.
Yum.
And call us and talk about it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The following is a message from the Climate Reality Project. Join us on September 14th to the 15th for 24 Hours of Reality, a presentation delivered in locations around the world, sponsored by former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. View the live stream at climaterealityproject.org. Go to our website, tell your friends, join our watch party, and help others learn about what can change in a day. Again, that's climaterealityproject.org. This is a message from Fork and Anchor. Aaron Fitzpatrick, the host of our wine program, Unfiltered, is looking for help on Kickstarter to open Fork and Anchor, a general store inspired by two food-loving ladies with an equal affection for urban life, the sea, and the agricultural paradise of Long Island's North Fork. The store is situated in a growing community of farmers and winemakers and will become a meeting place offering prepared foods, a variety of sun-dries, and a selection of homespun products, many of which will have their origins in New York State. Your backing will help them fulfill their dream of fostering relationships with the community and making the local food system accessible on a broader scale. Search Kickstarter.com for Fork and Anchor and donate today.